Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT, the weekly conversation with people who are shaping the technology landscape. I'm Peter High, and before we begin this week's broadcast, I'm excited to share that this month marks the 10th anniversary of the Forum on World-Class IT. My sincerest thanks to all of our guests and our listeners who've made this podcast such a success over the past decade. I'm also delighted to announce that on December 3rd, we will rebrand our podcast as Technovation with Peter High. We have a lot of exciting guests lined up, so be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. And as always, if you like what you hear, we'd be grateful if you'd give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. Thank you. My guest this week is Seth Goldman. Seth is the co-founder, president, and chief executive officer of Honest Tea, the nation's top-selling ready-to-drink organic bottled tea. As CEO, or as he sometimes refers to himself as TEO, Seth is responsible for overseeing the company's mission to be the first organic and fair trade brand in the world's largest beverage distribution system. Seth has degrees from Harvard and Yale, and he's also the chairman of the board of Beyond Meat and a board member of Ripple Foods and Bethesda Green. In this interview, Seth discusses the origins and growth of Honest Tea, how he overcame the company's 2003 bottling crisis that had the company on the brink of collapse, and the unique equity structure that he put in place that put the company in a position of strength when it was sold to Coca-Cola. Seth, welcome to the broadcast. It's great to speak with you today.
Good to be with you, Peter.
Excellent. Well, Seth, I wanted to certainly have a a broad conversation about your business, Honest Tea, the company that you founded. But actually, I'd like to take a step back even before its founding to the other person whose signature is on each of your bottles,
right.
And that's Barry Nailbuff,
right.
A professor of yours at the Yale School of Management, where he still is a professor, in
Absolutely.
Fact, and a guy at the time who was well known for writing Coopetition, for instance, widely published and widely highly regarded Yale School of Management professor. Talk to me a bit about the development
sure.
of that relationship.
Yeah, well, it's fun. So both of my parents are professors. Hmm. And when I was growing up, we had, I would say, rigorous academic discussions at the table. So I wasn't afraid to engage in that. And Barry, to many students, was an intimidating presence. He is very bright and quick thinker. And there was more than these stories of students who were brought to tears in his classroom. So I was fortunate that the first course I took with Barry was a course on political and economic marketing. And having worked on presidential campaigns beforehand, that was sort of my wheelhouse. And so my first interactions were with him from a position of strength. I had sort of some, I'd say good thinking and insights that he found, positive. He had a positive impression of. So then the next course I took with him was a competitive strategy course. And there, too, we had some creative ideas. And I actually put together a business plan for a totally different business, actually something related to urinary tract infections. And Barry thought that was really showed bright and creative thinking in it. So, I certainly appreciated his creativity as a professor and his sharp thinking. And I think he saw the same in me. But I also, part of it was that I wasn't a pushover or a shrinking violet in the classroom. And I think he appreciated that, too, because sometimes that strong presence like that actually, it can make a positive impression when someone else sort of pushes back,
Exactly.
the right way. And so we were, I would say, very friendly and, stayed in touch. And I didn't launch Honest Tea until 1998, so it was a few years after I had left Yale School of Management that I reached out to him. During that time, we had continued to stay in touch. I would, every once in a while, I'd ask for his advice around a career decision I was looking at, or I would share with him an interesting article or something like that. So it wasn't like I totally reached out to him out of the blue. But when I did go for that run in Central Park and felt thirsty afterwards and saw there was nothing there, I immediately recalled my conversation that I had had in Barry's class about the fact there was something missing. And it was so fortunate that he had just come back from India and he had been at a tea auction and had been playing around with names and came up with the name Honest Tea. So when I told him, I think I'm ready to launch this less sweet drink company, he said, well, I know a great name if you want to do that.
Wow.
And I'd love to be involved.
That's
and
great.
So it was very much a alignment of the stars or the tea leaves, as it were. And then this was in the fall of 1997. We started to share ideas, where we shared label names, shared ideas for recipes, shared tea. We'd sell tea leaves to each other. But then when it got clear that it was really time to say, are we doing this or not, I took the train up to New Haven and sat across from Barrietta's kitchen for most of the day and just wanted to talk it out. Like, he wasn't leaving his day job. That was what I would be doing. And so I wanted to make sure, I had the full picture, and he as well, of what are we doing here? Like, what's the goal? What are the roles? Not just sort of the short-term goal. What are your life goals? It kind of got to be that big a question, because we had to understand, and I'm glad we did. That was the best, trip I ever took to New Haven, because we had clarity about what we were coming, what we brought to this enterprise, what we hoped to get out of it. What was the time frame we had in mind? And all of those things helped lay a foundation for a great partnership, which, by the way, still is in place today. We're no longer actively running Honest Tea together, but I still stay in touch with Barry. And he just sent me a fun picture of himself at a subway station in New York, where there's just surrounded by Honest Tea advertisements, which he was very happy to see. Yeah,
it must be very gratifying to see that yourself as well.
Yeah.
What I do find interesting, as you alluded to, the kind of classic entrepreneur's spark of an insight where there was something you wanted and couldn't find.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And but I'm wondering, as you mentioned, there were ideas prior to this when you were pursuing as well. Did you have kind of the entrepreneur's bug early?
I did. I did. I have always thought of myself as an entrepreneur, and there were other ideas that I had actually pursued, some, nonprofit, some for profit, but, and this was interesting because obviously, as I said, the idea for Honest Tea actually came in 1995. We just didn't do anything about it. Mm. And I think, your listeners or readers often will find in retrospect, there's an idea that comes across and people just don't do things about it. And this was one where, although I didn't take immediate action on it, eventually part of it was the confluence of me being at a point in my life where I was ready to do something about it. Part of it was I was thirsty after that run. And just at that moment, I was thinking and realized that this could be something that I could be passionate about and really pour my efforts into. And I think for me, at least, and it's not true for everybody, but as an example, this other business idea that I had developed in Barry's class around urinary tract infection the idea was to take a urinary tract diagnostic and put it in an adult incontinence diaper. The reason that's a good idea is because it's the elderly incontinent that are most prone to urinary tract infections and the hardest to catch a sample because they're incontinent, so they can't always control when they produce it. And by putting it in a diaper, you basically make a diaper a medical device, which makes it reimbursable. And so for nursing homes, it becomes a very useful. Anyway, that's an idea that's an interesting business idea. It's not something that connects with me around passion and impact. Now, you could say, well, fewer people will die from urinary tract infections, and that's true. But it wasn't something I could relate to. And whereas the idea of making a drink that could quench my thirst and in the process, have all these impacts around the environment and on the supplier communities and the consumer is something I still get very excited about. So that was why Honest Tea was a much easier concept for me to jump into.
And yet you've spoken in the past about how you were relatively ignorant about this industry.
Yeah, it's not as totally. Not just relatively, totally. Yeah. I think I drank beverages. That was the level of my beverage experience, which most people have.
But in some ways, it sounds like that was to your advantage. Because if you knew too much, you might not have. This is an incredibly complex business, right?
That,
as you know so well.
Well, I would say incredibly complex. It is, any business is challenging to get into. It's difficult because we have, you have to get distributors, you have to get production facilities. Mm-hmm. But at its core, it's not that complex, right? Mm-hmm. It's, especially what we make. We take tea leaves and we put it in a bottle and we brew it. We do have to acidify it and sweeten it, but that part is relatively simple. And then we have to sell it to people. That part's relatively simple, mm-hmm. but it's the actual convincing people to take the product and to execute. That part that's where it gets complicated.
Right, exactly. The distance between, especially in the early stages, between you and the consumer.
Right.
There are several people you need to impress order to get this into people's mouths.
But there's no magical algorithm to make tea, right? It is the world's second most popular drink, second only to water. So literally billions of people make their own tea around the world. We just make it in a particular way and package it and brand it in a particular way.
Were you a big tea drinker before this business?
So I had spent a year in China and a year and a half in Russia, which are both big tea drinking cultures. And it was there that I developed an appreciation for tea. And I did like iced tea when I was, you know, in the States, but I just had given up on the category because it was so sweet.
Yeah. And so a couple of the things that were differentiating, as you mentioned, was trying to make it a tad sweet as
yes.
opposed to something that was loaded
that's
with
critical.
Sugar.
Yeah.
And also you've talked about how a big difference was using actual tea leaves
right.
Instead of powdered tea,
yeah.
something that's sort of like a distant relative
yeah.
of the actual tea itself.
Yeah.
And so talk a bit about some
sure.
of those nuances.
Well, that was the genius of the name Honest Tea. And it really was. It was a tea that tasted like tea, first of all, because it was brewed with real tea leaves, and most bottled tea was not. Most, and still is not. Most bottled tea is brewed with a powder or syrup and you add water. So brewing with real tea leaves and putting just minimal sweetener in, so you're tasting the tea and not the sweetener, and that was another way to dimensionalize. Then, of course, the much longer and deeper connection to the name is, can we create honest and healthy relationships with our suppliers, with the ecosystem, with all the consumers we connect with, and that's certainly informed the way we try to do business.
And how did you find suppliers, I guess, at the beginning and now?
So in the beginning, we literally were going to tea shops and buying loose leaf tea. This was 1998 or 7, so it was early on with the internet. We'd order some stuff online and find some things we liked. And then what would happen is we would end up buying much larger quantities, and the tea shops didn't make sense. So we knew who was supplying the tea shops. And then once we got larger and we're working with brokers, we knew who was supplying the brokers. And so we got more to the grassroots level and developed some very meaningful relationships with the different tea gardens that we work with in India and China primarily.
Yeah. And it was fairly early on that you had a fortuitous, meeting with a Yale School of Management grad who put you in touch with somebody at Fresh
Fields.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was even before I launched. I knew a guy named Joe Dobrow, who was head of marketing at Fresh Fields, which was the 17 stores for the Mid-Atlantic, which eventually became Whole Foods. And I reached out to him, as I reached out to a lot of people, I reached out to him just to say, here's an idea I have, and I figured this is someone who knows something about this business. What do you think? And so he gave me insights and eventually helped open the door for an appointment. But I reached out to basically anybody. So I reached out to a guy who had a beer company. I reached out to a woman who had interned with a juice company. I reached out to people who had worked in grocery. So anybody who could give me insights, because of course, as I said, I didn't have any. I reached out to a few different people who had different tea shops. And people were very open and helpful. And that helped me inform how I started.
And it sounds like a period of, as any early portion of an entrepreneur's journey, a period of great tenacity. Once you had a foot in the door you were giving away more tea than you were selling.
Oh, yeah.
You were in those stores, as I understand, with several interns and trying to, in fact, I think I remember in some of the Whole Foods here, like having some of those free samples.
Sure. Well, it was, this was, so one of the key decisions we made, and as I mentioned, when I went up to Barry's house, that was part of it was, do I take the plunge?
Mm-hmm.
And what was interesting is that Barry said at the time, well, instead of taking the plunge, instead of leaving your job at Calvert, you could go on sabbatical.
Yeah.
And I bet you they'd let you do that. And he's right. They probably would have let me do that because they valued what I was doing there. But I knew I had to be all in. Like, this wasn't something I could do part-time or on weekends. I had to be all in. And once you're all in, you just find ways to make things happen. And so, yes, we were giving out. We gave out more samples than we sold, but we ended up becoming the best-selling tea in the 17 Fresh Fields stores that first summer. And that was a great launch pad to go to all the other Whole Foods stores and other stores as well. But, that marketing, of course, is more expensive because it is hand-to-hand. It involves a lot of – it's labor-intensive, but there's no substitute for it. There's no better way to connect with the consumer than literally hand them a sample, explain them what they're tasting, and it's a much higher conversion rate. Just someone seeing a sign and not really understanding what we're selling.
That's really interesting. And I, so as I understand it, you were actually profitable fairly early.
Yeah,
Is that right? Or, I mean, in the giving away, perhaps not, but how quickly into the relationship of...
About 8 years into the business, we got to a place where we were close to break even.
Oh, got it. Okay.
And we said that, you know, while break even is a nice place to be, the clear mandate for the business is to grow.
Yes.
And so we said, okay, well, at least we've got decent margins. We could be break even if we wanted to, but that's not what the purpose here. The purpose is to get growth. And so, you know, I've joked that we were... we acted like a nonprofit for our first 10 years, not only because we had such a strong mission component, but because we had no profits either. it was lean. You know, the returns of both sort of our salaries, everything was on paper. You know, there wasn't much of a salary there. There was. I mean, we did pay salaries and we had benefits, but it was lean living those first 10 years for sure.
And you and I think you've credited to Barry had some pretty creative ways in which you sought funding.
Yes.
That allowed you, as the company grew, to retain a tremendous amount of the ownership. Yeah. Can you talk a bit about
that? Yeah, so this was, as one of our investors says, this is an equity structure that only a game theorist could love. Well, Barry is a game theorist, so that he described that accurately. But what we did was, so a lot of entrepreneurs, when they start a business, will issue themselves penny stocks, and then just, they own a ton of the company. Well, we said, let's invest on the same terms as our founding investors, but we'll give ourselves warrants, which only become valuable if the value of the shares of the company grows. And as the share price grows, the warrants become in the money, and then we gain more equity as a result. And so that that was a very effective way to help us keep control. And eventually, you know, when we did end up selling to Coca-Cola, we really did from a position of strength. And if you look at the legacy, which there are probably hundreds now, companies that kind of lost their way, it was because they often had to sell at a place where they either, not desperation, but were like a Hail Mary. And we didn't do that. We took in the investment from Coca-Cola as it came in as a minority investor and a welcome party. Obviously, no one forced us to do it, but it was done in a way that we still kept control until we decided to ultimately sell. And I think that some of that still goes back to the fact that we had that equity structure in place.
That makes sense, yeah. And I know it's interesting, when you launched this, it was, as you alluded to, kind of the first phase of the dot-com era.
Yeah.
So it was a very non-traditional startup from that perspective. Yeah. And I imagine in some ways it was probably difficult to find investors who were looking for something.com and you were not something.com.
We were selling old school business. And what's funny is, you know, the dot-com entrepreneurs were selling some ether, right?
Yeah.
You know, but their equity structure was relatively simple. Our equity structure was complicated, and that did make it a little more challenging to raise money during that time, especially since it was the first time I was raising money.
Mm-hmm.
But we got the hang of it, and by the time we were, you know, past, I guess, you know, 6 or 7 years into it, raising the money became fairly straightforward.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
And along the way, you had a real crisis with the bottling. There was a point at which there was
2003,
exactly
glass,
right. Yeah. Can you tell that story, please?
Yeah. So, you know, glass bottles are something we've been in from the start. But in 2003, our supplier delivered us a load of glass that had just blisters in it. Something had gone wrong in the production facility. And so what happened is, because we heat the liquid up to 190 degrees, so the glass has to be able to withstand that heat. And when the blisters are inside the glass, they can't withstand that heat, and so they explode. And so we just kept having to shut down the line. And every time you shut down the line, you get an explosion, you've got to remove glass on either side. And despite all the efforts, they still ended up with some glass in a bottle at two different Whole Foods stores. And we're not, you know, small pieces, but nonetheless, obviously something that's not supposed to be there. And fortunately, no one got hurt or injured, but it was scary because Whole Foods has a policy, 3 strikes and you're out. And we were one little piece of glass, you know, away from being kicked out of Whole Foods, which was the core of our business.
Right.
And so we decided, just for both safety reasons and for reputation risk, and we got this name Honest Tea, like we can't have that risk out there. We pulled all of our products from the market. First, we tried to say, let's just pull the product from that production date, but it was just too complicated. We had to pull everything off the shelves, and that was a small company still, you know, doing about, I don't know, $4 million in sales. So it was really a painful step to take, but ultimately was the right step to take. We pulled all the product out and we brought new product back. And we also started to diversify our packaging, and we launched a line of plastic bottles as well, just because we realized we could never be in that position again.
Yeah.
And we haven't fortunately had any problem. We haven't had problems since then. But it was, you know, we still like the glass bottle, but we're also fine with PET because environmentally there's merits to both.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the, just a side note, we've just launched Honest Tea in Germany now. And in that market, we have a reusable glass bottle. So this bottle is, we sell it, and then a consumer can return it to the store. It gets picked up by the local bottler, the Coca-Cola bottler. And then they can clean it and refill it. So that's neat. Going back to the old days of how, you know, so a closed loop around packaging is
like
really
milk delivery from way back when.
Yeah, yeah, so that's exciting for us.
That's very interesting. And it was fairly early on. You mentioned the Coke acquisition, which I'd love to get to.
Yeah.
But before then, you became the target of you know, companies coming after you and exploring whether or not you'd be willing to sell. Can you talk a bit about that as well?
Yeah, well, it, ironically, literally in 1998, we got approached by a summit. So this was a case of we had just hit the market and someone was interested in buying us. I said, there's nothing to buy. Like literally, I mean, I sell you some bottles of tea, but we have barely sold those ourselves. I think one of the best pieces of advice I got from one of our board members, a guy named Jeff Swartz, who was the CEO of Timberland, the footwear and apparel company, said, build the business and the brand like you're going to own it forever. Don't think about, try to build this to flip it. And that's actually another important difference with us and the .com folks. And so he says, if you do that right, there's always going to be opportunities. And so we definitely had the long game in mind. And yeah, over the years, different companies wanted to buy us. But they often wanted to buy us and basically just take over the business. And we knew we were just in the very early stages of building something. Frankly, I think we're now building, bringing it to scale. But we knew the cement hadn't stuck, or the batter hadn't, you know, been baked. And I think what's true about us now is that, you know, the DNA of Honest Tea is hardwired now. It is about organic, lower calorie, fair trade whenever possible. And so I feel like we did sell at the right time because, number one, we did keep the management control for the business during that vitally formative period. And number two, as we bring this to scale around the world now, we're seeing, whether it's in Germany or Spain or, of course, the United States, the brand really does, every manifestation of the brand is the DNA is represented there. Mm-hmm. And so that, to me, tells me we kept the right controls in place and sold at the right time.
So many acquisitions like this in this industry and beyond, the management team leaves pretty quickly.
Yeah.
You know, they take the product and do what they wish with it, but so much changes as a result of the acquisition.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering clearly that's not what's happened in the now 10 years since the initial investment from Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
What was that negotiation like, if you don't mind my asking, to have you comfortable with the fact that this wasn't going to be that sort of an acquisition?
Sure. Well, there were a few keys to it. The first one was that when Coke invested, they only bought 40% of the company. They were a minority shareholder. And so
eventually had the right
to buy the company. Yeah. But for those first 3 years, they really couldn't dictate to us. They had some veto rights. So, you know, we couldn't launch a cola or something like that. But other than that, it was our business. And what was important about that was we tripled the business in size during that time period. And we also demonstrated an ability to run and grow the business with integrity. And so when they had the option to buy the rest of the company, first they took the option. This is a valuable business and a valuable team. And then they said, this is working. You know, no other part of our business is growing at 3x. let's let this team keep doing what it's doing. And so that's largely been the inspiration for what we have today. I mean, today I don't run the business the way I did then. I've spent half my time with Honest Tea and half my time doing other things. But the idea that we have this brand that is absolutely part of the Coca-Cola company, but also a little bit of its own entity as well. Its own team, its own ethos, its own way of doing things, of sourcing things, is still very much the case. And so, you know, the foundation of that was laid during that period. with their investment.
And talk a bit about where you see the company going from here on. Yeah. I've just seen your R&D facility a few rooms over. And
you're being generous. Yeah. We call it a test kitchen. And even that's a little generous. It's a countertop.
Right, right.
But, you know, what's been really exciting over just the past few years, and so one of the reasons, the other relevant question is, well, why am I still around, right? Because, you know, the business is sold. The financial upside is largely,
been realized.
Been realized. So, but for me, I'm around because these are kind of the days I used to daydream about during those first 10 years when it was tough. Like, number one, could we bring this brand to scale? Mm. And that's what we're doing. So now we get to see our products launched and offered in national chains, national restaurants, and beyond that, now in international markets. And so being able to bring this organic, low-calorie, and soon-to-be fair trade in Europe product to these markets is really exciting and gratifying. It's what I hoped would happen. Someone said to me the other day, or I'll say this to Barry too, well, did you ever dream this would happen? Yeah, absolutely. This was the dream. And so, you know, to be able to be around, and by the way, to make sure it doesn't get messed up is also, you know, there's double benefit for that. And so this is still fun. We see the brand now growing to a scale where it is significant and making an impact in people's diets and certainly in agriculture, around organic agriculture, and with respect to fair trade certification as well. We're now, I guess just last year, was over $500,000 in fair trade premiums that went back to these communities, which is really material in terms of the impact we have on whether it's the schools or healthcare or their infrastructure.
And how big is the company now?
So we will do this year over $500 million in retail sales. So, you know, the goal we've always talked about with the investment was to get this to be a $1 billion brand. And, you know, we're more than halfway there.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, and that doesn't include the international sales, which, of course, is just starting.
And you've been based here in the D.C. area for 20 years.
Yeah.
Talk about the D.C. community. Anyway. Uh-huh. So many people think of this as a government town, and surely it is, but it's also a very dynamic business community as well. What are your perspectives?
Well, we love Bethesda. For us, it's been a great place to live. Certainly, you know, our sons grew up here, but it's also a great place to have as a core market. It's a very much a conscious market, a lot of educated and thoughtful people. And it is the one thing that's notable is there just aren't many consumer product companies here. So we are a little bit out of our different that way, but I never had any, it's funny, when we started the company, someone was saying, well, you know, you got this organic or natural company. Shouldn't you set up a P.O. box in Vermont or New Hampshire? Like, first of all, that's not honest.
Right, there you go. Yeah.
But second of all, there's nothing wrong with Bethesda. And I've never suffered for, you know, being here. I think, obviously, a lot of what I do is travel, and it's easy to get in and out. We have since, I've since been the co-founder of a group called Bethesda Green, which it's helping to develop a sustainable economy here in Bethesda. And one of the things we have is an incubator for early stage companies, and it's a green business incubator in particular. So it's nice to feel like we're helping to create that ecosystem for the next wave of entrepreneurs who are interested in this.
That's right. And is that where you spend a large part of the other 50% of your time that you referenced before?
No, so my other 50% of my time, I mean, I'm on the board of Bethesda Green, and I support it, and I'm very happy to be involved. But my other main undertaking is to be executive chairman of a company called Beyond Meat, which is a plant-based protein company based in California. And it is the first plant-based burger to be carried in the meat section of grocery stores. And so, you know, just as I launched Honest Tea because I was thirsty, I got involved in Beyond Meat because I was hungry. My family's been vegetarian for 13 years, but just consistently dissatisfied with the plant or the veggie burgers, which I don't even want to talk about that and Beyond Meat in the same phrase, because those were always just a disappointment. And what's been so fun with Beyond Meat is this is a product that looks, cooks, and tastes like beef, but is made from plants. And when you think about the health and environmental impacts of being able to do that globally, it's very powerful. It's a huge category of food, and we're seeing that this is really the first breakthrough product that is bringing in meat eaters to this space, you know, whereas the percentage of people who are vegan or vegetarian is roughly 5%, and they buy their product in the freezer. But the fact that we can get this product carried in the meat section means we're reaching a much wider audience, and the sales reflect that.
Wow, that's fantastic.
Yeah, it's really fun.
Are you spending a lot of time in California as a result
of
that?
Yeah.
Where is the headquarters?
It's based near L.A.
Yeah.
And spend, you know, about a week a month there in person, but a lot of other time there just working on helping the company grow strategically, thinking about how we what we develop, who how we build the team, a lot of growth capital. This is a very different financial approach. So Honest Tea, you know, in our first 10 years, we raised $10 million, basically $1 million at a time, you know, but not even $1 million at a time, sort of $25,000 at a time, leading to, you know, $1 million raise. Beyond Meat has raised over $100 million in private equity, and it's just a different way to run a business. And so it's fun for me to have, you know, look at it, even though it's a lot of the same playbook, it's different dimensions to it, for sure.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
At Honest Tea, do you have a favorite tea, or is it like asking you to rate your
favorite
child?
I've been loving our Tulsi, which is a basil leaf tea. So it's an herbal tea, and Tulsi is called holy basil in India, and it's really just got a wonderful taste to it, and there's a wonderful sustainability story around Tulsi because it's an intercrop. It grows in between other crops, and so the farmers can gain incremental income, and much more valuable. What Tulsi was primarily grown for was actually garlands that just get worn once and thrown away. And so if you can sell something instead of like a, almost like a souvenir, to sell it as a food product, it adds value. And so it's really helped these farmers make a sustainable living. It's wonderful. Wonderful story, but wonderful taste as well.
Well, Seth Goldman, great to hear your story. I really appreciate you taking time with me today to share it.